This is KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Tuesday, July 11th of 2023. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Coming up on today's program, we'll hear about a new state-level tax credit for the purchase of qualifying electric vehicles. Nearly half of U.S. homes have PFAS compounds, the so-called forever chemicals coming out of their faucets. That story and more on This Week in Water. And we'll go to our listener comment line to hear what's on the minds of listeners. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have an update from the BBC News headlines. Then it's How on Earth? Coming up on The Science Show, journalist Gloria Dickey will discuss her just-published book called Eight Bears, Mythic Past and Imperiled Future. At 9 a.m. comes another archival recording of The Wit and Wisdom of Alan Watts. Then at 9:30, Greg Schultz will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. That's all still coming up, but first, it's time for the headlines. With KGNU's John Kellen.
A new lawsuit stemming from the Boulder County Sheriff's report on the December 2021 Marshall Mesa fire has been filed against Xcel Energy. Filed Monday in Boulder County District Court, the lawsuit alleges that Xcel's failure to implement safety measures with its power lines on the day of the fire directly resulted in widespread destruction. KGNU's Jacob Agaston has more.
Boulder County residents John and Julia Uradil filed the lawsuit for the, quote, substantial losses and harm, which remain ongoing, end quote, caused by Xcel. The plaintiffs, who are represented by a national law firm known for wildfire lawsuits, allege that Xcel had a duty to safely design, operate, and maintain its infrastructure, but failed to do so. The lawsuit claims that one of these duties was to decrease the chance that a power line causes a fire, and that Xcel knew of the high fire risk on December 30th, 2021, but did not take action. The lawsuit alleges willful and wanton conduct and negligent infliction of emotional distress, among other claims by Xcel. The sheriff's report last month found that there were actually two causes to the Marshall fire, one from the Xcel power lines and another from embers from a fire on a residential property 6 days earlier thought to have been extinguished. On the day the investigation results were made public, Xcel released a statement disputing the findings, saying it strongly disagrees with any suggestion that Xcel Energy's power lines caused the second ignition. The suit asks for a trial by jury and a reasonable amount of compensation to be determined by the court. The Marshall Fire destroyed over 1,000 homes and businesses, took two lives, and is considered to be the most destructive and costly fire in Colorado history. For KGNU, I'm Jacob Agaston.
In western Colorado, meanwhile, the Spring Creek fire is reportedly over 50% contained, but officials say full containment is still months away. The wildfire began on June 24th southwest of Parachute in Garfield County, and as of yesterday has burned some 3,200 acres. About 500 firefighters have been battling the fire on the ground and by helicopter. Their efforts have been made more difficult by the rugged terrain. Because of that, containment is not expected until about October 1st. There have been no evacuations, and the fire's cause is under investigation. Two state Democratic lawmakers are suing their own caucus for what they are calling pervasive violations of Colorado's open meetings law. The suit by Representatives Elizabeth Epps of Denver and Bob Marshall of Highlands Ranch says that regular meetings of House Democrats are not always publicly noticed and that minutes from those meetings are not always recorded and made public. It also says that the use of an encrypted smartphone app called Signal is in violation of open meetings and public record laws. Epps and Marshall say they brought their concerns to party leadership, but no action was taken, according to the Colorado Sun. House Speaker Julie McCluskey and House Majority Leader Monica Duran said in a written statement that they're committed to open, transparent, and fair government. The lawsuit also names Republican Mike Lynch, the House Minority Leader, and the entire GOP caucus. A record number of people lost their lives in traffic accidents on Colorado roadways last year. Now, state officials are taking measures they hope will keep those numbers in check. KGNU's Yvonne Olivas has the story.
763 deaths have occurred on Colorado's roads this year, according to the State Department of Transportation. More than 745 crashes and 7 fatalities were reported this past 4th of July weekend. State troopers are planning to expand their visibility on major roads by partnering with local law enforcement across the state. According to the Denver Post, speeding, lane violations, distracted driving, and driving under the influence caused the majority of accidents last year. For KGNU, this is Yvonne Olivas.
The Colorado Department of Human Services is opening a new 52-bed mental health transitional living home in Denver this September. The facility will open in four phases at the Sequoia Cares Partners LLC. It will serve Coloradans whose mental health conditions don't meet the criteria for hospitalization but are unable to live independently. Patients can receive appropriate care and stay as long as necessary. Beginning today, motorists will have to pay a toll when using express lanes on a 10-mile stretch of Interstate 70 through northeast Denver and Aurora. The amount of tolls will vary depending on the type of vehicles and time of day. Tolls are higher during the morning rush hour and also higher for those not using express toll transponder tags. The weather outlook for Metro Denver, the National Weather Service says we can expect a hot one today with sunny skies and temperatures in the mid to upper 90s. In Denver, look for a high temperature of 97 degrees, a high of 95 in Boulder and Fort Collins, and up in Nederland, a little cooler, with a high expected to be 79 degrees. For KGNU, I'm John Kellen.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Colorado has a new state tax credit to incentivize the transition to electric vehicles. Joining me live in the studio is Carrie Atia, Associate Director for Transportation, Fuels, and Technology at the Colorado Energy Office. Good morning.
Good morning, Shannon.
This new tax credit went into effect at the start of this month. What exactly does it do?
So the tax credit now for Colorado taxpayers is a $5,000 tax credit for the purchase or lease of a new electric vehicle. In Colorado, we have a really robust goal of having 940,000 electric vehicles on our roads by 2030. And so we want to make sure that we have the policies and the programs and the incentives in place to be able to incentivize and encourage Coloradans to make that switch to electric vehicles. We also know that transportation is our largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the state of Colorado. So as we are looking at all the different options and opportunities to be able to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the state from all sectors, we know that transportation makes up a really significant part of that. So this tax credit is in effect, as you said, beginning July 1st of 2023 for the purchase or lease of that new electric vehicle. And consumers can save $5,000 now on that purchase.
And that's $5,000 at the state level. But can these be combined with a federal tax credit?
There is also a federal tax credit available as well for electric vehicles up to $7,500. There are some income requirements and some manufacturing requirements as well. So if a consumer is able to stack now the state tax credit of $5,000 and that federal tax credit of $7,500, that's up to $12,500 of savings.
So these tax credits are for personal vehicles. Are there any plans or programs already in place for transitioning fleets?
There are. There are additional incentives available for fleets and for medium and heavy duty vehicles, including school buses. So we are really looking at transportation across the board holistically in order to reduce emissions. I'll also mention at the federal level, there is also now a used electric vehicle tax credit available of up to $4,000. So while the $7,500 tax credit at the federal level is for new vehicles, and here in Colorado, that $5,000 is available for new EVs as well. For those consumers that are looking to purchase a used electric vehicle, there's also a federal tax credit for that now.
So where does the money for these state tax credits come from?
Tax credits are provided by the state through our general fund resources. And so that consumer is able to then receive that tax credit when they're filing their annual tax returns or can work with their dealership to see about getting that tax credit at the point of sale.
So you have to put up the money up front and then get it back on your taxes if you file all the paperwork correctly?
In some circumstances, yes, but we are working to make sure that there are also opportunities to be able to receive that discount up front at the point of sale rather than having to wait.
Okay. So how long will these tax credits be available?
The $5,000 is in effect through January 1st of 2025, and then it will be reduced. And so now is just a great time to purchase that electric vehicle for somebody who's considering whether to go the electric route right now, being able to take advantage of that full $5,000 between now and the end of 2024. This is a great time.
These tax credits are obviously a financial perk, but how does the overall cost of owning an EV compare to gas-powered vehicles?
It's a really good point. And so while we have now these incentives to lower that upfront purchase price of the electric vehicle, considering those lifetime costs of the vehicle are also really important to consider. So when we look at the ability to charge an electric vehicle at home versus filling up at the gas tank, a consumer is going to see about 75% savings in their overall fuel costs. And then in terms of maintenance as well, there's up to 40% savings in maintenance costs of an EV compared to a conventional gas vehicle.
How many EV models are currently on the market for Coloradans to choose from?
There's about 70 total different makes and models available of electric vehicles right now. So consumers are able to find that make, model, and price point that is best going to fit their budget. The Colorado State Tax Credit applies to those new EVs up to $80,000 of MSRP. There's about 35 vehicles.
Translate MSRP for us.
Manufacturer's suggested retail price. So that sticker price that you see on the window when you're shopping for that vehicle. So that $5,000 is available on a vehicle up to $80,000. And then there's about six electric vehicles now on the market that are under $35,000. And that's also important because starting January 1st of 2024, the state will be offering an additional $2,500 tax credit for those EVs that have that MSRP of $35,000 or less.
So not so much here in Boulder where the charging stations are pretty much everywhere, but what's the infrastructure like for charging your vehicles, I don't know, on places like in the Western Slope or in Southern Colorado?
Really important consideration when people are thinking about purchasing an electric vehicle. Most of the charging happens for folks either at home or at the workplace. So we know that about 80% of most charging today happens at home or at the workplace. Of course, not everybody has access to charging at their home. So it's important to consider where those public charging stations are also available. We have over 4,800 charging ports across the state of Colorado right now. You can find all of those at the PlugShare website as you are planning your route around the state, whether you're traveling here in Boulder throughout the Front Range or going to the Western Slope, Southern Colorado, or the Eastern Plains. And we are significantly investing in building out that infrastructure to make sure that that public infrastructure is in place.
Now, in our almost final question, I also know about a program that is coming up that has to do with being able to exchange your gas-powered vehicle for an electric vehicle. Can you give folks a preview of that?
Sure. So starting next month, the state will be launching the new Vehicle Exchange Colorado program to incentivize income-qualified Coloradans who have an older, high-emitting vehicle to turn in that vehicle to receive a rebate for the purchase of a new or used electric vehicle. So we really want to be able to focus on those vehicles that are emitting the most emissions and be able to get those vehicles off the road and replace them with electric vehicles.
And you had said earlier that there's a goal to get the amount of vehicles to up to, what, 900,000 electrics? What's the current census of electric vehicles here in Colorado?
Right now, we have about 85,000 electric vehicles registered in the state of Colorado, and our goal by 2030 is 940,000. Momentum is really great right now. In 2022, over 10% of all new car sales were electric vehicles, and in the first quarter of this year, in 2023, it was over 13%.
Carrie Atillo, where can listeners find out more information about all of these new programs that are coming into effect?
We have a great website available for Coloradans at evco.colorado.gov. The EVCO campaign was launched at the end of 2022 in partnership with the Colorado Energy Office and the Colorado Department of Transportation to answer questions that we know Coloradans have about purchase incentives, charging infrastructure. There's a shopper tool available. If you would like to find an EV event to do a ride and drive event, there's a calendar of events there. So go to evco.colorado.gov to learn more.
Carrie Atiyah is the Associate Director for Transportation, Fuels, and Technology at the Colorado Energy Office. Thank you for joining me in the studio today.
Thanks so much.
Up next is This Week in Water with Jamie Sudler and Franny Halperin.
Painkillers are derived from crude oil, but that could change. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Nearly half of the homes in the United States have PFAS compounds, the so-called forever chemicals, coming out of their faucets, according to a new study by the U.S. Geological Survey.
The agency tested water in kitchen sinks across the country, unlike other studies or monitoring programs that focused on water treatment plants or groundwater wells.
PFAS chemicals have been used in a wide variety of products, including fast food containers, nonstick cookware, and firefighting foams. They can lead to health risks such as decreased fertility, developmental defects in children, and some cancers.
The chemicals get into water when waste or products containing them are disposed of or used on the ground. They can also be released into the air and end up in rivers and lakes. PFAS compounds break down very slowly and can accumulate in human and animal bodies and the environment.
The researchers found that the likelihood of PFAS contamination is greater in urban areas than rural.
Earlier this year, the EPA started the process to regulate the amount of the compounds in drinking water, and in June, some manufacturers of PFAS, including 3M and DuPont, agreed to multi-billion-dollar settlements over pollution claims.
Japan's plan to release contaminated water into the ocean from the Fukushima nuclear plant got the go-ahead last week from the country's nuclear regulator. And while many are opposed to the plan, the International Atomic Energy Agency concluded that the discharge, which could go on for decades, is safe.
In 2011, the Fukushima plant was shut down after a massive earthquake led to a tsunami with up to 20-foot waves that caused the reactors to start melting down.
There are already 1,000 large tanks filled with the contaminated water at the site, enough to fill 500 Olympic-sized pools. The company that runs the plant has been pumping water every day since the disaster to cool the reactors, and now they say there's not enough space to store it.
According to the Japanese government, the water will be treated so that most of the radioactive materials are removed, but tritium and carbon-14 will remain. It will be discharged through a 1 kilometer tunnel off the coast of Japan into the ocean.
Tritium and carbon-14 are radioactive and emit low levels of radiation, but can pose risks if consumed in large quantities. Tritium is already discharged from other nuclear facilities around the world at levels within regulatory standards that are even higher than what is proposed at Fukushima.
However, the plan has been met with significant opposition, including from China, the Pacific Islands, and Japanese fishing communities. And despite the South Korean government's support, there's widespread opposition among South Koreans, leading to protests in the streets.
While it is unclear when the releases will begin, it could be as early as this summer.
In recent weeks, Texas has been trapped under an oppressive heat dome, which occurs when the atmosphere locks in hot air like a lid. Many parts of the state saw temperatures hovering in the triple digits, triggering excessive heat warnings and leading to several deaths.
Unfortunately, for construction workers or people whose jobs require them to be outside, getting into the shade or sipping water when temperatures soar could become more difficult under a new law.
In what critics have dubbed the Death Star Bill, cities and counties will not be allowed to pass regulations intended to protect workers from heat if their local ordinances go beyond state rules.
Signed by Republican Governor Greg Abbott in June, the bill is set to go into effect on September 1st. It will override local laws that mandate water breaks and time in the shade for people working in areas such as agriculture or oil and gas.
Labor groups condemn the legislation as dangerous to public health, and the city of Houston is suing the state, calling the law unconstitutional. Meanwhile, climate scientists project that Texas summers will get hotter as the planet warms, predicting that by the end of the century, the state will have 3 or 4 times as many days above 100 degrees Fahrenheit as it has today. And finally, to solve the climate crisis, we need to ditch fossil fuels pronto, not just in transportation, but also in a huge range of products, including pharmaceuticals. Yes, common painkillers like ibuprofen and Tylenol, they're manufactured using chemical precursors derived from crude oil.
Scientists from the University of Bath recognize that making drugs derived from fossil fuels is not sustainable and contributes to greenhouse gas emissions. So they came up with a plant-based source, pine trees.
The research team developed a method to refine turpentine the conifers produce and used it to make acetaminophen and ibuprofen. Pine trees produce more than 350,000 tons of the compound every year, and it's also a waste product from the paper industry, so there's plenty to go around.
The team was also able to synthesize additional precursor chemicals from the turpentine, including ones that are the basis for beta blocker medicines and the asthma inhaler drug salbutamol, as well as other compounds used for perfumes and cleaning products.
They hope their more sustainable biorefinery approach could replace the need for crude oil in the chemical industry and perhaps make keeping oil in the ground less of a headache.
That's it for This Week in Water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
We go now to our comment line to hear what's on the minds of listeners.
Good morning. And I was just calling to comment about what has been going on in Jenin, West Bank, Palestine. What's interesting is that it's referred to as the Jenin refugee camp, as if refugee camp is the normal suffix behind any city's name. It was established in 1953 as an escape from Israeli occupation on the West Bank, and especially after the 1967 war. They've said that only a few residents have been killed. Yeah, but if we look at the 1999, I think it was, where Gaza was invaded, not Jenin, but Gaza, over 1,000 were killed, almost all civilians, and a handful of Israelis were killed. And I use the word handful on purpose, because when you're matching thousands against dozens, you can only call it a handful. There was also another attack on that area in around 2004, where almost 2,000 Palestinians were killed. This is an area, the West Bank, that the United Nations overwhelmingly, way over 80%, said should be returned to the Palestinians, that it was occupied illegally by Israel. So let's not just take into consideration what you see on the news, you know, that 10 Palestinians were killed, and think that that's the extent of it. Let's just look at Jenin, which has been under a siege since 1967, with occasional sporadic entryway by Israeli forces, including in some cases tanks. And that's all I have to say, is let's look at it holistically, and not just as a one-off incident. It's a continuing incident, which has gotten worse, or will get worse, under Netanyahu. Thank you.
Hello. I'm deeply concerned about the plan to send cluster bombs to Ukraine, and also about the Israeli actions against the Palestinians. It's genocide. And so I appreciate the fact that KGNU brings up international issues, and I really hope to hear more about these two very important issues. Thank you.
If you'd like to make a comment on something you heard on KGNU, you can leave a message at our listener comment line at 303-447-9911. Individual comments longer than a minute and a half may be edited for brevity. That's it for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host and producer, Shannon Young. Thanks to John Kellen, Jacob Agatston, Yvonne Olivas, Alexis Kenyon, Jackie Sedley, Jack Armstrong, Franny Halperin, and Jamie Sudler and interviewee Carrie Atia for their contributions to today's program. Stay tuned for How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show. That's coming up after the BBC News headlines.